Michael Marmot of UCL at UC and Robert Sapolsky from Stanford.
Thank you. I'm still reeling from the fact that for male baboons, status declines dramatically with age, and older males are reproductively dead. When I get over this shock, I'll remind myself something that Robert Sapolsky and I said in our paper, that I am not a baboon in a jacket and tie. Humans are different, and there is a great deal of variation among primate species. So we shouldn't expect such a simple read across from one primate species to another. There are differences, and those differences really matter. Here's one difference. This is where Robert Sapolsky, this is the ecosystem in which he has labored, and this is the ecosystem in which I have labored. I do wonder whether I made the right choice. These are the primates that Robert Sapolsky has studied, and these are the primates that I have studied. Civil servants are classified by their level in the hierarchy. And we see that level in the hierarchy in Whitehall is closely and intimately related to survival. There's no survival paradox among the males. Not just do they live longer, but they have better health. And I used to say that a high-grade administrator was the perfect physical specimen. British permanent secretary was the end point of biological evolution, apart from the average woman, of course, who lives longer. When Richard Sussman alluded to this yesterday, that in looking at civil servants, other human species, and studying status and survival, I've got a screening test for economists. If you show somebody the link between social status and longevity, if that person says that health causes social status, that person is an economist. It's not a perfect screening test. There are false positives and false negatives, but it's a good deal better than PSA screening for prostate cancer. Far fewer, almost to a person. If you show them the link between status and health, the economists, if they say that health causes status, they're an economist. There may be psychoanalytic explanations of this. It may be due to what they learned in Economics 1, but it is a remarkable finding, and it crosses continents. It's remarkable in different cultures. And no amount of evidence will shake them from that conviction. It's a bit like the nature-nurture debate. People don't change sides just because of the evidence. They interpret the evidence in the light of their prior convictions. It really is quite remarkable. One way that convinces me that were I on the other side, I would change my mind, is actually getting inside the black box, actually showing what's happening biologically, and I would say crossing species. This is perhaps another way. It's not just civil servants. These two graphs come from figure one from my review of health inequalities in England that I'll mention before I stop. And the top graph represents life expectancy for every neighborhood in England classified by income deprivation. And what you can see, I think, is that people who live in neighborhoods that are near the top have shorter life expectancy than people who live in neighborhoods at the very top, the right-hand end are the least deprived. People in the middle have shorter life expectancy than those near the top. People a third of the way from the bottom, shorter life expectancy than those in the middle. It's a social gradient that runs all the way from top to bottom. If you're an economist and you believed that people's health determined position, you'd somehow have to say that people who are just a little bit unhealthy choose to live in neighborhoods that are a little bit less affluent than the really healthy people who choose to live in the really affluent neighborhoods. And people who are sort of moderately healthy choose, somehow they match themselves to these middle-ranking neighborhoods. It's garbage, complete and utter garbage. The world does not work like that. The bottom curve is disability-free life expectancy. She's coming to sense it now. Sorry, did I say a word to you?
I'm coming to.
I thought maybe I said something you're not supposed to say in the national kind of sense. The place is probably run by economists. The bottom graph is disability-free life expectancy, and you can see that the gradient is steeper. So in fact, the gap between the two curves is bigger at the bottom than it is at the top. This relates to Max's point about social mobility. There are two ways to think about social mobility, where individuals are in the hierarchy, and what happens to society as a whole. Society has improved dramatically over the century, last century, for everybody. Living much longer. This is a representation where I've drawn, I got somebody to draw for me, height proportional to life expectancy. So you can see in the 1960s in England and Wales, my cartoonist messed it up by gender problems, assume that the doctor is actually in drag, he's a male. Otherwise it gets confused with gender. So in the 1960s, there's this social gradient in life expectancy. Height is proportional to life expectancy. Now, in the 1990s, the lowest grade man, low social class, unskilled laborer, had longer life expectancy than the top grade man in the 1960s. Things got better for everybody. So one way of thinking about the social gradient is to think about the worst off, and the worst off got dramatically better. The issue is that the best off got dramatically better and actually got better a bit faster, so the gap increased. So there's variation over time in the gradient, and there's variation among countries. My colleagues and I have also done a review of social determinants of health and the health divide in Europe. And this comes from our European review. SE is Sweden, EE is Estonia, Hungary, Romania, Sweden, Italy, Norway, etc. And this is life expectancy at age 25 by education, international classification of education. It's a gradient, but we pulled out the low education and the high education. So look at Sweden. This is life expectancy in age 25 for those with tertiary education and for those with the basic level. And the two items here, one is that the worst off are pretty good in terms of life expectancy. And so are the best off, and the gap between them is quite small. Look at Estonia. The worst off, pretty bad. Life expectancy at 25 is just over 35 years for those with low education, but it's up here at 53 years for those with high education. So as you look across the different European countries, what you see is that the variation for people with high education is much less than the variation with people with low education. In other words, if you're at the top of the pile, it matters a good deal less where you are. If you're at the bottom of the pile, it matters enormously where you are. So the social gradient is much steeper in Estonia and Hungary than it is in Sweden and Italy and Denmark. Now it varies, and it varies particularly to the disadvantage of the worst off. Now, my colleague Richard Wilkinson published a book, The Spirit Level, where part of what they claimed was that big inequalities damage the best off as well as the worst off, damage everybody. Well, that's not what these data look like. The best off aren't being harmed very much, or not nearly as much as the worst off. For women, we see the same pattern, but commonly the inequalities, the social, less for women, the social gradient is shallower. And a point that Robert Sapolsky and I make in the paper is social gradients are contingent on other circumstances. So if you look at obesity by, this is among women, by female education, we can have a conversation afterwards, by the way, of whether body mass index is bad for life expectancy. It is bad for life expectancy. I know there are papers that claim it's not, but the body of evidence is it's not good. Obesity by education, Q4 is high education, Q1 is low education. Countries where the gross national product is less than $745 per capita, high education, high obesity. That kind of makes sense. In a very poor country, if you're really at the bottom in a very poor country, you just don't have enough to eat, can't get obese. And more education correlates with higher income and so on. But you don't have to be in a very rich country before the gradient's flat, pretty much. And above $2,900 per capita, we see this familiar inverse gradient that all of our countries. Interestingly, much the inverse gradient for obesity is much stronger and more consistent for women than it is for men. And how much that's cognitive, that high status women care about appearance and do Pilates and go to the gym, God knows what else, and how much it's other things, we can debate. And then we see the consequences, for example, diabetes in India, poorer, richer, diabetes levels go up, presumably very largely because of obesity. But when you get into a country that's somewhat richer, like Argentina, education, there's diabetes prevalence. The lower the education, the higher the diabetes prevalence. The lower the income, the higher the diabetes prevalence. So you see this change in gradient. In a poor country, get a bit of money, you get fatter, get more diabetes. Even in a not very rich country like Argentina, get a bit more money, you get less fat and less diabetes. So it's somewhat contingent. One of the issues with trying to debate the causes of the social gradient health in humans, I've mentioned reverse causation, but is it lifestyle? Is it that the heist I mentioned, Pilates and going to the gym, reading the New York Times can make you very unhappy because you find this week that watercress is good for you and last week watercress was bad for you and coffee's good this week, it's bad next week, and so on. So it could be that high status people are more sensitive to the health information and they're acting on it very quickly, hyper quickly. It could be lifestyle, in other words. It could be, as commonly thought in the US, because you have this bizarre way of wasting money on the most inequitable health system. That some people don't get access. I pull my hair out. Why you do this ridiculous thing you do with the health system? And some of our politicians look at the US and say, yeah, that's what we'd like. And say, oh, God, no, no. But so a lot of Americans worry that the disparities in health are due to lack of access to health care. And that may be part of the story, so it could be lifestyle. When you come to baboons in the wild, they have miserable access to health care, all of them. None of them, as far as I'm aware, not even Robert Sapolsky's baboons, read the New York Times science pages to find out whether watercress is good or bad this week. So a lot of those explanations that you think about in humans simply don't apply by social gradients in health in non-human primates. And Robert studying his baboons, and I studying my civil servants and other human variants, think that psychosocial factors are vitally important. Low-ranking baboons, a summary of Robert's studies, sluggish response to stress, the adrenocortical profile, elevated basal glucocorticoid secretion, and sluggish recovery. Low-ranking baboons have high blood pressure, reduced HDL cholesterol. These are features of what we call the metabolic syndrome in humans. Testicular suppression, reduced IGF-1, reduced lymphocytes, and overactive system. If we look at HDL cholesterol in male baboons and male civil servants, something went really bizarre with the labeling here, but forget it. The dominant baboons have higher HDL cholesterol, which we think of as protective, and the civil servants are very like baboons in more ways than one. The dominant civil servants have higher HDL cholesterols. And Robert's model is the problem, in part, is with the feedback loop of the HPA axis. So in the subordinates here, instead of higher levels of circulating cortisol switching off the hypothalamus, you get blunted sensitivity of the effect of the hypothalamus on the pituitary, whereas that feedback works well in dominance. So you get higher outputs down the line here in the subordinates. So higher levels of corticotropin, higher levels of cortisol. And he shows that in subordinate baboons and depressed humans, you have similar physiological patterns. The macaques, Robert tells me, are like the baboons, and I think Steve Simi said, yep, that's probably right. Subordinates have high basal glucocorticoid levels, blunted feedback sensitivity, stress-induced anovulation, elevated blood pressure, atherosclerosis, low HDL cholesterol, and decreased lymphocyte counts. But other species, you don't see the same pattern. And the summary and what we did in the paper was to try and look at what Robert concluded from looking at primates and try and apply that to human societies. So what does rank mean for a particular individual? What does it mean for a particular population? What does it mean for a particular species? Stable or unstable hierarchy, what's it like for dominant individuals and what's life like for subordinates? And just one example of the cross-species comparisons. This is looking at cortisol levels in low-status animals relative to high-status animals for 10 different primate species. And they're classified according to the degree to which subordinates are exposed to social stresses. So in other words, if it's really god-awful being a low-status baboon, if they really, or other primate, if they really dump on you rather badly, a lot of stress associated with being low status, then the relative excess in cortisol levels is bigger than if it's not so bad. We've started to do cortisol studies in our civil servants in Whitehall 2 study. This is one of the earliest studies looking at cortisol and socioeconomic position throughout the day. And the lower grades have higher cortisol levels in the morning, and it continues for a good part of the day. And as you see this diurnal variation, at the end of the day, there's no difference. Looking at psychosocial factors in civil servants, I've been particularly concerned with disempowerment one way or another, low control. of what it means to be a low status baboon is to be disempowered, low control. The high status man, guy can take your lunch away, take your female away, take your freedom away. And part of what it means to be a low status civil servant is to be lacking in control. This is the association of civil service grade with job control. High grades, more control, low grades, less control. And we have shown, I won't go into it now, we've shown that low control is associated with increased risk of cardiovascular disease, of depression, of sickness absence. Looking at the metabolic syndrome, and here we're looking at job strain, high demand, low control, and social isolation. The number of times people report that, the greater the exposure to ISIS strain, the greater the frequency of the metabolic syndrome. We've also looked at effort-reward imbalance at work in a number of countries across Europe, and looking at poor health by effort-reward imbalance at work. People who have a high imbalance, in other words, high effort, low reward, are much more likely to be in poor health in each of these countries. I've been particularly concerned with the poor health in Scotland, and particularly in Glasgow. I've pointed to the fact that life expectancy for men in the poorest part of Glasgow is 54. Shall I say that again? Life expectancy for men in the poorest part of Glasgow is 54. Glasgow is in the United Kingdom. It's not in India. And life expectancy for men in the poorest part of Glasgow is 54, 9 years shorter than the average for India. And in the richest part of Glasgow, it's 82, 11 kilometers apart. The kilometer is a measure of distance. 28-year gap in life expectancy. Looking at Glasgow, my colleague Harry Burns compared Glasgow with Liverpool and Manchester. They had three post-industrial cities, similar levels of poverty, similar levels of inequalities, yet Glasgow has higher mortality than Liverpool and Manchester. Look at the causes that show the biggest relative excess: drug-related poisonings, alcohol, suicide, and external causes. They're all psychosocial. And Harry Burns, who until 10 days ago was the chief medical officer for Scotland, said it's low control, it's disempowerment that's responsible for the high mortality. I'll skip for a moment because I'm about to be thrown off. Max Weinstein, talking to me yesterday, and I said, I've been involved in trying to package our scientific findings in a way that might influence policy. Max looked at me, I could tell the expression on her face, she was thinking, it's a pity. It may not be a shame, but it's a pity you should waste your time this way, because clearly nobody will listen. Max, they've been listening, so I decided to just put this in. I chaired the WHO Commission on Social Determinants of Health. We published our report in 2008, and we called it Closing the Gap in a Generation. In the wake of the WHO Commission, I was invited by the British government to conduct a review of how we could apply those recommendations in one country, in England. And I called my report Fair Society, Healthy Lives, a statement that if we put fairness at the heart of all policy making, social justice, could you imagine that? Could you imagine the US Congress around the corner putting social justice at the heart of all policy making? I said that if we did that, health would improve and health inequalities would diminish. And we're just in the process of finalizing our publication of the European Review of Social Determinants and the Health Divide. The English review, we had six recommendations through the life course. Every child should have the best start in life, education and lifelong learning, create fair employment and good work for all, healthy standard of living, minimum necessary for a healthy life, healthy and sustainable communities, and a social determinants approach to prevention. And this was for Max. Is anybody listening? A survey of local government in England asked them what their priorities were for health and well-being. And number one was Marmot principles. In fact, a local councillor from Manchester, whom I met, not in the health field, she said, "You're Marmot." I didn't realize Marmot was a person. We talk about implementing Marmot. So we've taken the science and we put it into practice. This is the conceptual framework for our European review. And I just want to finish with one example, early child development. We look at inequities in early child development. So at the top, Denmark, Finland, Netherlands, Switzerland have the most equitable distribution of child well-being, material circumstances, education and health. Iceland, Ireland, Norway, Sweden, Austria, Finland, the UK's got to be somewhere. Oh, there we are, near the bottom. But I do like coming to the United States. The only country, big country, that's got greater inequities in early childhood than we do. I think we understand a great deal about the science of early child development. One example, and then I shall stop. Looking at preschool education. The percent of children who are enrolled in preschool education, and on the same graph is the percent of children at level four who have reading scores in the sixth grade at level four. So Cuba has 100% of children enrolled in preschool education and have the best reading scores in sixth grade. Then Costa Rica and Chile, and down the other end, Paraguay, Dominican Republic, Colombia, Peru, low preschool education, poor reading scores. We understand the science of early child development rather well. We know what would make a difference. It's a matter of putting it into practice. And what we said at the end of our European review was that health is a human right. For countries that are doing very little, do something. For countries that are doing more, do more. And for countries, if you're Sweden, you're doing a lot, do it better. Thank you.
We take a-